Welcome to Sci-Fi Show Outcast 65. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Today I have a really interesting interview with Dr. Gary Habermas. We're talking about his work on near-death experiences and empirically verifiable aspects of them. I hope you find it as fascinating to listen to as I did to record it. Enjoy! Thank you for joining us on the Sci-Fi Show today, Dr. Gary Habermas.
Well, I'm glad to be here with you. It looks like we're going to be able to get a chance to sit and chat a little bit about NDEs, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Not a worry. So first up, for people that don't know who you are, can you tell me a bit about yourself?
Well, that's always kind of an odd question, but, you know, when you don't want to just say, well, I'm so-and-so and so-and-so. But I'm a distinguished research professor at Liberty University in the United States, and I taught here for, I think this is my 26th or 27th year, and I'm the chair of the Department of Philosophy and Theology. I've done a lot of book writing over the years, 30-something books, and my chief area of interest concerns topics like the resurrection of Jesus and near-death experiences, basically topics having to do with, let's say, religious topics with a bearing on afterlife.
Okay, so you're joining us for a discussion of NDEs. I guess the right place to start is, what is an NDE and do they come in different types?
Okay, well, near-death experience is kind of, let's say, popularly kind of broke on the Western consciousness back in the, let's say, about 1970. Before that, there were some, you know, kind of that off-the-wall kind of literature, and you'd pick it up here and there, and you couldn't figure out if it was reliable or not. There were some good studies before that time. I'm not trying to say they weren't. But in 1970, in the early 70s, several researchers, including some medical doctors, decided to do some systematic, at least interviewing, if not testing, of near-death procedure. Now, even the category near-death, I remember the days when discussions were even being done as to what the name of this phenomena should be. They're not post-death experiences. And finally, a researcher, I believe it might even have been Michael Sabom, who was one of the better-known researchers in this area. He may have been the one who coined the term, but I don't recall that exactly. And near-death was defined as a reported experience from a time during which a person could fairly be believed to be close to death and from which they would die, a situation from which they would die if they did not get immediate attention. So that's more the, you know, the wordy kind of definition. The actual state might be initial cessation of life signs, pulse, heartbeat, just from a person who is observing the situation and perhaps calls the emergency, or maybe the person's a rescue individual themselves, and they know that this person's in some kind of trouble. And that's the state from which many of these experiences are reported.
Okay. So what sparked your interest in near-death experiences?
Well, I was just, in the early 1970s, I was, I was coming to the end of a long period of religious searching, and I had been going through a time of being pretty skeptical, probably close to, at this point, close to almost 10 years of being fairly skeptical of particular religious claims. And I, you know, somebody would say to me, well, have you checked this out or have you checked that out? And one of the things that, you know, I'd mentioned to me was this, what at that time was not even being called near-death experiences. I'd read a book some years before that purported to give some of these and other type accounts, and I couldn't make sense of whether these books were, these reports were well evidenced or not. So I just started keeping my eyes open for reports on the subject, and as I indicated earlier, the question of the afterlife has long been one of my central, if not my central, area of concern. So when someone starts saying, I saw heaven, or I was in hell, or I was looking down at my body while they were doing these fantastic things trying to revive me, and at first I didn't even know it was my body. You know, you start listening and wonder what's going on. Then some psychologists and medical doctors started collecting this material and testing when they could, and there were some early groups that would meet together, and I remember about 10 years after that, in the early 1980s, meeting with a group of researchers up in the northeastern U.S., and they're a very serious group of researchers. Probably right now, among this group would be the biggest named near-death researchers, or most of them. And we got together and we discussed some of these things, and my interest has kept up from that time on. But I guess the short answer would be it came from a time of religious searching and especially evidence seeking in my own life.
Okay. Evidence for an NDE, aren't they just faulty brain chemistry as a person dies?
Yeah, and that was the early reports. There would be a list of medical trauma or non-trauma views that would say perhaps near-death experiences can come from one of the following. And among those would be, say, temporal lobe seizure, oxygen deprivation, wishful thinking. I don't think too many people thought much of a thesis such as lies. You know, tell these people are just lying. But you know, somebody would bring that up once in a while. But mostly the medical ones would say, here's what they all had in common. You are in a subjective brain state of one sort or another, and the mere fact that others have experienced a similar state, i.e. light and a review of one's life or aspects of one's life, the fact that hundreds, and then later it's found out thousands, and then in a later survey, millions of people have claimed this phenomena, that can't be considered anything other than a subjective brain experience because other people have had it, that just might mean that all of you have the same brain chemistry. So that might be all there is to it. And part of my search was how I could answer these objections, because those type of objections are very tough ones if you don't have any data, and it seems to me you're going to have to leave the stories right there unless you can do something about it.
Okay, but what sort of empirical data could you claim? I mean, how are you going to verify somebody's trip to the afterlife? That seems all a bit ethereal to me.
Well, yeah, and the whole thing you just asked, there's a number of loaded questions there. I mean, for example, one might be just concerning the afterlife itself. But the major question is, could these kind of experiences be written off as subjective experiences? The way I went after this and the publishing I've done on this, what I decided to do was to, and I'm not trying to imply I'm the only one who did this or that nobody else thought of this, but at the time, a number of us who met in those early groupings and before and since, one of the ideas was to provide evidence that this is more than a subjective brain state. Now, the first thing I'll say is what I did not conclude. I am impressed enough with the criticism, like the one you raised, that I would never say something like, well, the fact that tens of thousands or a few million, according to one survey, by the way, the one I've referred to here, almost 8 million Americans alone have claimed to have data like experienced things like this. But I would never argue that similarities in these experiences show that they went to some common reality. I think they're interesting, but they're rather beg the question of what caused this. So what I did was I started collecting cases, and I now have, well, I'd have to go back and count, probably over 100 now, but I started collecting cases, evidential cases, where somebody would report something that could be verified. Now, just for a simple example, I mean, this will sound fairly complicated, but there are actually better evidence cases than this. Let's say a person has a near-death episode, a state from which they can, with good reason, said to be close to death, and a rescue team gets a hold of them, and they know that this person was in distress. Let's say they passed out, or let's say, you know, something happened at, let's say, 2:15 in the afternoon, local time, and the folks who come to rescue them get them stabilized, let's say, within 45 minutes. Well, if during that time, let's say right in the middle of that 45-minute time stretch, let's say the fellow who, as I earlier said, he reports hovering above his body and first wondering who in the world was that down there on the ground that they're, you know, whose chest they're beating on, who's this guy down there. First of all, he can't see his face anyway because people are over top of him. And secondly, he just normally considers his existence from the point of his consciousness. And he's, you know, 10 feet above that point. So he's observing this and rather amused by this state of affairs. And over on his right or left side, he notices another kind of attention-grabbing procedure. And maybe 300 feet away, 400 feet away, he witnesses a car accident, and he can describe what car hit what car, what colors they were, apparently what happened. We know the person was out during this 45-minute time, but we also have a police report that says that there was a car accident roughly 20 minutes after the onset of this problem. And let's say that the fellow, when he's brought to, let's say he comes to and one of the first things he says is, how's that woman doing who was driving that green car? So they know that there was no time here for somebody to tell them the story. So it's that kind of a thing. And some of them are very, very complicated. Because when you have a heart attack, for example, when you have a real heart attack and not just heart difficulties, what happens within, they know from experiments now, cardiology, that at about the 10 to 12 second mark, you have a flat brain wave reading. So you could potentially very soon into a heart attack have no heartbeat and no brain waves. And if you plug that into the situation and the person reports a car accident from 20 minutes later, well, that becomes very evidential.
Okay. What does a flat brainwave activity mean effectively, though? Couldn't it just be below the level of what the instruments can measure?
Sure. And that's a good question. What does a flat brainwave mean? Well, first of all, if I were just to play off your question, and I could make this kind of philosophical response. I could say, all right, let's grant that the cords for the EEG and in the cases where it's actually hooked up, let's just say someone hooked it up improperly, or let's say it only measures higher level brain activity, not lower level brain activity. My comeback would still be, assuming you have a case, and there are a number of them, where a person reports data with flat brain and flat heart, the EKG, you'd still have to say that if there's no known, if the heart's not working and there's no upper level brain activity, that would have to still be very, very significant. And if the person said, well, it could be lower level brain activity, there's a certain type of philosophical response at one level where you want to say, well, the person says there could be lower level brain activity, and you respond, well, there might not be. And the person says there could be, and you say there might not be. The point you're trying to get across there is just to assert something there could be doesn't make it true. That's just, you know, one quick comeback. But then you have to go in there and spend a little bit of time and say, well, let's just say for the case of the question that there was lower-level brain activity. Why would we think that an experience that is highly evidenced and the person says it's the most significant thing that's ever happened to them in their life. Let's add that there's a profound life change, which there almost always is. There's a profound life change. The person is no longer afraid of death. They're much more willing to help other people. They become a much kinder, well-balanced person. Why would I believe that all of those results could come from lower-level brain activity when this seems to be a very high-level experience and results? So, so you could say, well, yeah, there could be some lower-level brain activity there, but that doesn't explain the richness of this whole situation. And besides, there's a third type of response, and it would go something like this. You're telling me there's no brain wave material, as far as we know, on the higher brain function. But if this person had a heart attack, as far as we know, there is no brain activity, period. That's what research shows, totally apart from any NDE research. Research as to what happens to a brain when the heart is not working is that the brain does not function very quickly afterwards. So the one level says, what about what were the waves, brain waves we're seeing? But the other type of response is that with heart-type cases, there's no brain activity. And if you're believing that the person had the most meaningful experience they ever had, and it was highly evidential, I think we're talking about some other things going on here and not relying on low-level, undetermined, unverifiable brain-level activity.
Okay. That's an interesting response. The way you're essentially turning the skeptical argument on its head like that.
Yeah, well, you have to... it was very easy for me to think like that because I went through these years of this sort of thing myself, and sometimes, this is not often appreciated, but sometimes, just like people who used to be religious and they're not religious now, have some of the best insights into what religious thinking is like. Sometimes people who were on skeptical quests throughout their life have the best sense of what it means to be skeptical. And I certainly thought that was me, because regardless of what I was inclined to believe or not believe, the question of whether there was evidence for me was a totally different issue, and I wanted there to be evidence. I'd come to the conclusion very early on that there was no way I wanted to have a kind of faith that said something like this. I believe these things. I don't know any of them are true, but that's just my brain state, and that's just what I believe. And so, quote unquote, that's true for me. Well, that's wonderful, but true for me doesn't tell me anything about the world, and I'm not going to live in illusion. So it was easy for me to think that way.
Okay. So I guess the obvious criticism that comes to mind of near-death experience reports is, well, they're not really dead, are they? These people are clearly, from whatever state they're in, are still alive. Well, at a later date, are still alive.
Yeah.
How can you feel...
Right.
How do you deal with that?
See, to me, Jason, that's to me is an extenuation of the previous question. That's just another way to ask... Well, what you're saying is, they're not dead. How do you know they're not dead? Well, because they're only near death. Okay, in a lot of cases, that's where the discussion stops. It's near death. But what about the flat brain cases? Well, there could be some lower activity. Okay, and so we're right back to the question before. But to the general question, what happens if this is just this is a near-death state, and we don't finally know what's going to happen when the brain is not operating, I still would say, okay, what about cases of heart attack cases where there's no brain or no heart? We know that there's no brain activity via cardiac experiments that have nothing to do with NDEs. We know there's no brain activity after, say, 20 seconds, not with a real heart attack. And I have experience beyond that point. But there also there's another species. See, in one of my treatments of near-death experiences in a book called Beyond Death, which I co-author with J.P. Moreland, a philosopher, I have levels. I have definitions of death And I ask, do we have any data beyond each of those points? And I've already kind of assumed those, except for the last one. And those levels would be, this guy's near death. He's only near death. Okay, so what do we have for him if we have evidence? We have a hint. We have a hint of an afterlife, but like you say in the question, it's a very good question, he's only near death. Okay, what's the next highest definition?